You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavor swirling together with cold brew, topped with a velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles, and that imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. Participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies. And if you are listening to Maltin on Movies, it means somehow you're not watching Christopher Maloney on one of the dozens of TV shows he's on right now.
People multitask. It could be on mute.
I know. But I mean, you know, they could be watching reruns of Oz or Law & Order SVU or True Blood, of course, or new episodes of Underground on WGN America, or they're about to be able to watch Wet Hot American Summer. I mean, you're omnipresent. You're everywhere.
Ubiquitous.
That's the
you
one.
You are ubiquitous, yeah. Sir. And welcome. And thank you for taking the time out to come to visit us.
The pleasure is absolutely all mine.
Well, we'll decide that. You'll
He's
decide
sassy.
That
I'm
in an hour.
About
I mean,
this.
When it's over, you'll tell
how
us.
How long does this go for now?
3 hours.
Woo, yeah. Time flies. Okay. Hey! Thanks for having me.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm terrifically impressed because you were just on. I don't watch Andy Cohen in general, mm-hmm. but Patti LuPone is my personal Lord and Savior. Yeah. And when
she's mine now.
But this is the thing. It pops up. I've got I'm doing work and I've got Bravo on in the background and suddenly it's Chris Maloney and Patti LuPone. I'm going, I'm sorry, what? And I look over and it's the two of you and I just thought, oh my God, it's gonna be like degrees of Kevin Bacon. I'm now one away from Patti LuPone sitting next to you.
There you are. Yes.
So are you guys engaged? Are you like in love with each other? Tell me.
We don't want to rush anything because you know the magic was there. We just you know how that happens. It's like, oh, you know. But it's real.
Yeah.
I just want the people out there to know.
You've just hung out recently now with Goldie Hawn and Patti LuPone. You kind of you're winning in every possible I know, right?
I mean really.
Oh, it's so good, though.
Hold on. I dropped a couple names.
Right? No, I'll drop them for you. Don't
yes,
worry.
Exactly.
Don't worry about it.
I have a bad back.
What,
I'm not going to pick
I'm
them
here
up.
For.
There are many names to drop.
Yes, there are.
I mean, you have worked, needless to say, you've worked steadily and in such a wide variety of shows and films over the last 20 years or so that I don't know who – well, if we're talking about East Coast, I don't know that there's an actor in Actors Equity – who hasn't crossed your path.
That's true. Boy, you know, I mean, you know, if you're connected to a Law & Order franchise, I mean, forget about it. You've been to any Broadway play. I mean,
if
you've been to Law & Order.
If you go to a Broadway play and read the playbill bios of the actors, somewhere in that bio it says Law & Order.
Yeah,
because that's the most employable.
I was going to say it's
franchise.
That's how actors in New York eat.
Yeah,
and survive.
Exactly. Yeah. And good for them.
Yeah,
and good for Dick Wolf for giving them the work.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Just amazing.
I absolutely agree with all of those things.
Now, but tell us about Wet Hot American Summer.
Well, you know, from the beginning or just this season?
Yeah, how you got involved?
So that was one of the rare moments. I was doing SVU, and so, you know, we have 3 months off, and I got this call to go to this audition. I read the script, and I got the script, meaning I read it, and I got it. But what locked and loaded it for me, what I found profoundly funny was the visual of all of the camp counselors who were going to be played. You know, so a camp counselor, your average camp counselor, 16, 17, 18-year-old, they're all going to be played by actors, comedians that I knew, you know, kind of peripherally in their late 20s to early 30s.
Yep.
And that just made me laugh in my head. So I go, and I especially the character of Gene that I was going to play, the camp cook, was especially appealing because he was crazy and the stuff that came out of his mouth was crazy. So I went in there and it was one of the rare times that I did an audition and it was exactly what I wanted to do.
Hmm.
And what I wanted to do, I knew, was who the character was. And so that there's a level of not cockiness but complete confidence and being completely assured of your motives, your behavior, and who this guy was. I did it, laid it down, walked out, said thanks very much. And so they saw it the same way I did. So they're very smart guys.
Right?
Yeah. And what adjectives would you use if this was a Rorschach test? What adjectives would you use to describe this fellow?
Oh, boy.
Um, delusional, big-hearted, split personality. I think of him as Jason Bourne. Jason Bourne, but
with a spatula,
but funnier. Yeah, exactly. With a spatula,
I love it. But that's the wild thing: is that if you ask someone what they know you from, the list is it's massive, and it's all over the place. And that's something I found fascinating. Is when my dad and I were talking about it. It's like I don't think anybody could say you're a this actor. Normally, you say to someone, "This is a character actor, it's a leading man." It's that you do everything, like but actually everything. And then you've even done theater. I'm an Anglophile, and my husband is from England. And I saw that you've done theater in Dublin.
Yeah.
Like, so is there anything you don't? Do you juggle? Like, what can't you do? Have you ever ridden a Zamboni? I'm really intrigued.
I was offered to ride a Zamboni.
I'll bet you were.
Ooh. Yep.
Why on earth would you turn that down?
Because I didn't get to drive it.
Oh.
No, see, that's it. I get that.
I wanted everything. I want the whole enchilada.
Oh, no.
I know I felt like, you know, I'd be able to float like little Miss America, you know, Miss Texas, you know, Miss Wyoming, just waving with that wave, you know, smiling. I was like, oh, no.
Okay.
Right.
Well, all right. Understandable. Well, here's another crucial question.
Go.
How'd you get involved with Harold and Kumar?
Oh, that was a great one. That was the shortest pitch I've ever received, which was I didn't have to audition, but they said my agent calls me up laughing and says, okay, here's the deal. Ford, and I was in the middle again of shooting SVU, which, you know, after you're done with that season, you know, you're really more liquid than solid, I've often said.
Yeah, sure.
And he said, okay, here's the deal. 4 days worth of work. I said, that's perfect. It's a comedy. I said, fantastic. Guy's name is Freak Show. That's your character's name.
Go on.
I swear to you. I went, now I'm intrigued. You had me in 4 days, but go on. And he said, and it will, according to them, require about 3 hours worth of prosthetic makeup. I was like, oh my God. It's like absolutely – it's everything I wanted to do, which was – I didn't want a big job. I wanted it. I wanted a comedy, and I wanted to disappear. And they provided all of those things. And so when I get there, and they put it, and we did a makeup test, absolutely fantastic. And I said, "Okay, where are his teeth?" And they went, "Well, there are no teeth." I go, "No." I was adamant. I said, "Guys, not to be a pain in the ass, but you can't have this face." And these pearly whites on this character, you have to have his teeth all screwed up. So I said, look, I'll pay for it if it's not in the budget, but I need teeth now. But they were nice enough to, you know, get the, you know, scraggly teeth that he
they
has.
Sprang for the teeth. That's
they sprang
nice to
for
know.
The teeth. Obviously, and in Harold and Kumar 2, where I play the Grand Wizard of the KKK, they sprang for a lazy eye. So, and I have an eye phobia. And so shame on me. They had, and it's a giant. It has to be a giant contact lens. It can't be like a normal one because
It has to cover the whole.
And I don't know if you know this, but if you wear contact lenses, when you blink your eyes, it rotates to help aerate the eye. So my brilliant idea of a lazy eye going would somehow always center up. And so the ophthalmologist would have to come and go, I'm sorry, but your eye is too straight. And she'd have to dig her fingers into my eye.
And you're phobic about this?
And I'm phobic. So I'm my
– Oh, Christopher.
There are claw marks on the side of the chair. We'd be in the middle of the show. Okay, keep the cameras rolling. Get on in there. Poke his eye.
If people knew what you were willing to give for your art
– Thank you.
They would have more respect, especially for that role.
Thank you. And you know, some people check it out. Also think of this. Shreveport, Louisiana, 5 a.m. in the morning. It was 34 degrees. I'm just going to say that.
Okay.
See, I thought when you said they sprang for, I was waiting for it to be like 5,000 count sheets. Like you had really, really nice KKK outfits and then you went with a lazy eye.
Are we talking about Egyptian cotton, KKK wear guys?
Absolutely.
No, they didn't. No.
Because in all the cartoons, that wasn't in the budget.
Yes. No.
Damn it.
Well. What does one say to that?
I don't know.
Now, you've also been in not one, but two Terry Gilliam films.
Yes.
That's a distinction of honor.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
The first one, I think the guy fell out because I got a call at the 11th hour.
Mm-hmm.
You have a role if you want it. Go down to Philadelphia. I was in New York at the time. I went down. And Terry Gilliam changed. There are a few moments in Chris Maloney as the young actor that changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
One was seeing Brazil.
Mm.
It blew my mind. I'd never seen storytelling like that. I now see it as being 30 years ahead of its time, 20 years ahead of its time.
And we're
time.
Talking about, just to be really clear, and if for anyone who maybe isn't in the know, we're talking about Terry Gilliam's wildly bizarre, underrated at the time. In fact, the studio almost shelved it.
Yes.
They weren't going to release it. And then, pardon the sidebar, the L.A. film critics, in a show of defiance, voted it the best picture of the year. And embarrassed that. Universal Pictures into opening it.
Were you a member at the time?
I was.
See, brought it back to him.
I like it.
It was
I got
Jack
no problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Give credit. Jack Matthews was the ringleader. He later wrote a book about called The Battle of Brazil.
Yeah.
And
I read it.
And that's what got it finally into theaters, where it developed what we now call, tiresomely, a cult following.
Yeah.
But it deserves that and more.
It does.
And so that film could change your life.
Yeah,
it's really so out there.
It is, and I knew, and I was unconsciously, I think I was smart enough to understand it. I remember. So you're watching this movie about this dystopian future, autocratic, Big Brother-esque kind of place that we were forced to live in, and in the middle of it, you're going, how come I haven't heard of it? I remember in the newspaper, it was an advertisement. One theater was showing it in all of Manhattan. I'm like, there's something wrong. There's something weird. And it really was this Big Brother-esque.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to censor and shut it down, and it found it's a little bit of a home with the help of you guys. So anyway, so Terry Gilliam was a hero of mine, mm-hmm. truly changing my life. You know, I mean, I put it right up there with the first time when I saw Raging Bull,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I couldn't believe it was in black and white. I couldn't believe the improvisational, truthful behavior between Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro. So anyway, that was another moment that changed my life. But so I meet Terry Gilliam, and I start crying. And I felt like such a fool because he's sitting there going, oh, hey, how are you doing? How nice to meet you. I'm like, man, you're the greatest. You changed my life. I'm like, going, oh, boy. Maybe we should have gotten another actor for the role. But and so, you know, God bless him. I auditioned for him for Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas as well. And he was very kind to me. And he was my –
The first one was 12 Monkeys.
The first one was 12 Monkeys, you know, with Bruce Willis. And, you know, I played Lieutenant Halperin. And, you know, just had a couple roles with Madeline Stowe. And I was going to be in it more. They didn't have a budget. They didn't have the budget to have me, you know, when they're at the final chase scene through the airport to try and stop them, the cops, you know, they had a local guy. That's the only one that they
Yeah.
So that's that for that. But I had to audition for Fear and Loathing, and all it was hotel clerk. And I went to him, and I had a buzz cut at the time, as I usually do. And my scene is against a cop in the late 60s, early 70s. It's a police convention in this hotel in Vegas. And I tell production, I go, well, I need a wig. Because I can't be, you know, I need to be the counter to what you're seeing across the counter from me. You know, you're seeing the establishment with those buzz cuts.
High and tight, yeah.
Yeah, high and tight, yeah. Obviously, of that day and of that, you know, with that particular tribe, you know, the policemen, you know, they keep it, you know, tight. I said, I can't look like a cop. And I look, let's be honest, I kind of look like a cop.
You do. You
know?
You absolutely do.
And it was supposed to be an effeminate hotel clerk. And, so I asked Terry Gilliam, they wouldn't do it for me. And Terry Gilliam said, give him the hairpiece, you know, just get him a wig, give him a dopey wig, you know, fine. And then I also went to Terry, I said, Terry, I go, the guy's name is Sven. I just know it. His name is Sven. He's like, okay. And he got me a little, you know, bat.
Oh, a name tag.
Name tag, Sven. And at the end, for the wrap gift, he wrote, you know, he illustrated, because he was the illustrator for the Monty Python crew, and he illustrated something. He said, you know, to our next project, you know, Sven, to our next project or something like that.
Oh, well, that's lovely.
Yeah.
But you made a creative contribution.
Well, you know, I think you always try to. I mean, you know, just because you are in the midst of genius or what you perceive to be genius, I mean, you know, it's incumbent upon you. I mean, you're there for a reason. You can't I think in art, that's the beauty of art. You can't kowtow to what is considered greatness or what has you have put in this place of awe. I mean, you're there. You're in the game now. In the game to play, and you have to focus yourself and bring the best of yourself. And it's not being a retiring flower, and it's also not being a troublemaker. It is really just standing your ground and knowing your truth and putting it out there and fighting for it to the best of your ability. And knowing when you've lost, and so you move on, you do the best you can with the parameters that are given to you, or to help to maybe show them where maybe they're erring or where these things might could be better. And, you know, that kind of happened with SVU. SVU, I went in there, and so I got the role, and I went to Dick Wolf, and I said, you know, you have me with three kids. And I go, I think this guy's four kids. And the first kid was, because I was he was Catholic, my character. Mm-hmm. I said, the first one was, they got pregnant while they weren't married. So that first kid forced them to get married. Mm-hmm. And I think that plays with the Catholic's head.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like a sign of sin or something. Mm-hmm. I just thought and so I wanted to put this guy under the most amount of pressure I could. And then I said, the second one was planned. Mm-hmm. I think the last two were unplanned twins. So it's not just three kids. You're like, oh, my. So I think this is a guy who is constantly under this, you know, putting him under pressure. And I also thought, and because he was so linear in his thinking, I thought he needed a tattoo. He was a Marine.
Mm-hmm.
So to show both things, that, you know, he was a guy who could kick ass, but also had a wild streak, you know.
Yeah.
That's what the tattoo to me symbolized.
But see, everything.
And what did he say? What was his reaction?
Whatever you want. He didn't care. I mean,
he wants 12 kids. We'll give him 12 kids.
Yeah, he's been, you know, well, he'd be like, I don't have it in the budget.
Right. I was just going to say, did he say, will it cost me any more money?
No.
but everything you just said, that's exactly why you work as much as you do. And the fact that you keep saying you get 3 months off, how the hell do you work as much as you do?
I know.
Do you sleep?
You know, I didn't.
And you have a family.
I do?
You do.
Wait a minute.
I was not supposed to tell you that. I'm really sorry.
I'm going to talk to my lawyer.
Right. Now, you have two kids, and I hope no guilt.
No guilt. God, good. My God, I love them.
Just checking. I was just checking. If that's too personal, did I step over a line, honey?
I'm not the one to ask.
But also, the other thing is I'm a lapsed Catholic, so that really helps with the, you know.
Okay. All right.
Funny.
Just checking.
Sweeped away the guilt.
Just checking. And you've had the very same spouse low these many years.
73 years. We're going on our 73.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yep. Wow.
Honestly. Maybe it just feels that I love it.
And the other people at the home, are they envious of you? Well, congratulations for that. Because that's an important thing.
We like to say in Hollywood years, that's like, what, 7,000?
Yeah, you know, I don't know about that. I don't feel that way. I know what you're saying, because it is a free spirit industry in a way. You really have to keep your aperture open, your heart open, your senses open, and that can lead to poor
life choices. Let's go with that. Life choices.
Well said.
But
I don't know. You know, I've been very lucky. I just look at it as, you know, you work on it. When you think that, you know, when you see that it needs a little bit of working and attention.
Yeah. And your wife is a production designer, too.
She was. Now she's a painter. And I know this is a podcast, but I'm just going to show you so you guys don't have to ooh and ah just out of the blue. You guys can keep talking, but I'm going to show you pictures.
Okay.
My wife.
He's scrolling right now.
My wife is a painter.
He's using his thumb to scroll. So
thank you for giving a play-by-play daddy of a phone.
This is my daughter.
Wow.
Who's how old?
She's 16. That's Sophia. Mm-hmm. That's my son. My wife painted that.
Oh my God.
Oh, gosh. And what medium?
Oils. And then this is...
Can you see the oils, folks?
Can
you picture the oils?
Well, you're active on Instagram.
Look at that.
So if people... Are those on Instagram?
They will be.
They're right?
Yeah. Well, you know, because I've been so busy with the snatched stuff.
Sure, of course.
We haven't done the proper plug.
Sorry, yes.
You have a small but funny role in Snatched, the new movie that opens, in fact, today.
Yes.
With those funny ladies, Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn.
Yes.
And there are some key supporting roles along the way that aren't a lot of screen time, but all make an impression, and you are one of them.
Thank you.
And it's a funny part.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a great time with it. Mm-hmm. And it was, I just went to the premiere. And it's, what the heck? The script was overwritten. You know, my part got cut down. But, I mean, the whole thing got shaved, and they did a wonderful job. It was a good education in how to form that. I saw a film being sculpted because I knew exactly what was on the page, obviously. And I saw it to a degree at which I've not seen the films that I've been in.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting and well done.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
Now, in working in series television, as for instance with Underground, which is very well, getting a great audience and great reviews.
What's important is my mom likes it.
Yes.
What's important here is that my mom likes it.
I got that memo.
The most avid TV viewer in the household is my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And
if she didn't like it, she'd tell you.
Yes.
Right to your face.
She sends good reports.
My girl.
Mm-hmm.
And says you're not necessarily a nice guy. In this show, you're a bounty hunter.
I think she said to me, "Bad man."
Yeah,
he's a bad man. That's what she sounds like. Sorry.
But working as much as you have in series television, and mostly quality series television, do you ever feel like there's a hurry up and just do it attitude? And if so, how do you convince the people around you that it's worth taking that extra beat? That extra moment to offer those contributions that you want to offer and to say, no, don't just slam this together. We can make this a little better or a little richer, a little deeper, however you want to describe what you do.
Well, I'll tell you, I actually am blessed with having a producer's internal clock in my soul. So I'm the first one to go, please let's not waste time. Let's, because I find that as the day, I think it's like in any endeavor, the more you go on, I mean, your clock is ticking. You have a finite fuel tank, and the more you crap around and, hem and haw or, let's set up the shot. Let's make it and you just have to rely on your director. I mean, try and hire the best and, if they've set up a great provocative shot or it's also up to them to go, is this shot worth the time necessary that's going to take, and I think it's what I said, that you fight your fight, but you also know when to, back off and say, okay. And I think that's one of the circumstances, which is, if you're losing the daylight, you can't sit there and stand on principle of this is what's best. Well, nothing's best if you don't get the shot off. So.
Yeah. You won't earn any friends doing that either.
Yeah.
Well, you always want to serve the product, which is the production, which is everyone involved in that. Mm-hmm. And I think it starts with the director because they're the captain on the field at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to work with them.
So let me ask about a couple of other movies, which were one is a really super big production, and I didn't mean to say super. I really didn't mean for it to come out that way. Man of Steel.
Yeah.
Now, talk about being involved or on the set of something as gargantuan as that.
You hit it right on the head. That's absolutely what I felt. I was fascinated. I felt as though I always use this expression, to be in the belly of the beast of a quarter of a billion dollar production.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating. I mean, anything you wanted. And what that means exactly,
yeah,
so the listeners understand, it's that means that you don't want for anything. It's not a lap of luxury, but you don't want for anything.
Yeah.
You know, we need a small main street in some town kind of in the Corn Belt. Yeah. They go to a small town. They say, we're going to buy out all these stores and we're going to buy this main street. We're going to buy the police department for a couple days and we're going to blow up your gas station, by the way. Yeah. You know, it can be done.
Yeah.
Then – beyond that, on the lower side of the spectrum, it's nothing. It's really, you know at the craft service table, it's going to be a bag of
bag
of Fritos.
Thing.
You know, you're sharing a trailer with four other people. Yeah. You know, so, but it was really great and
if you'd wanted crooked teeth, they would have provided them.
They would have had four sets of crooked teeth and various shades of dinginess. Yeah, but it was a really cool, really fascinating. And, you know, as an actor, I mean, you get – so, you know, you need – we're going to come in and fight the aliens. We're coming in on a mission and I'm coming in on a chopper. Well, let me tell you, I came in on a chopper.
Right.
You know, banging over the cornfields at 20 feet. I mean, you're like, wow, when do you get to do this? It was fantastic. But then I'll also say that I played a guy, a character was Colonel Hardy, who was based on a Navy SEAL who had lost his life in Iraq. And so, you know, that sobered me up and that actually gave me a particular and a valuable center.
Well, that changes the playing field completely.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Because, you know, here you are in this, you know, what I thought was a beautiful story. I felt as though it, you know, I thought it was a beautiful lesson to be putting out there, which is, you know, everyone thinks, oh, I want to be Superman and then I'll be invulnerable and I won't have any problems, right? Because I can do all these things. And, you know, I felt their take was, the idea is you're different. Superman's different. Mm-hmm. And the even he has challenges.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
that idea of everyone's trying to find a place in the world to fit into.
Right.
Well, they say he's the ultimate outsider. Superman's the ultimate outsider.
There you go.
Yeah.
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 So, yeah, that was my experience, you know, both my personal responsibility I felt. Mm-hmm. But also the awe and the wonder and the cool factor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there I was at Edwards Air Force Base. I was just outside Chicago, and then I was in Vancouver. It was all over the place.
Wow. Now, I am not old enough to remember him vividly, but I do remember a colorful guy named Leo DeRocher.
Yeah.
Who managed the Brooklyn Dodgers, and you played him in 42 with Chadwick Boseman as Jackie Robinson.
Yeah.
So what's that like? I mean, there again, enough time has passed. He's no longer in the public eye. He's no longer a household name, except for people of a certain age who don't matter.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're not aiming movies at people of that age. I mean, meaning me. And people older than I, but for the target audience of movies, they don't even remember there were such a thing as the Brooklyn Dodgers. Dodgers. But Leo DeRocher was a very, very big personality.
Yeah.
And did you study him? Did you feel you wanted to imitate him in any way?
Well, you know, it's the small things. You know, just outwardly, guy was a character. He was someone who loved the limelight.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was a classic extrovert. I think he was recognized as a very good manager, Midland ball player. I think he had a way with people. You know, he was a charmer. You know, he he got the moniker is a, you know, man about town, and he actually was not, you know, a big drinker.
Mm-hmm.
He was a big goer outer, always, you know, looking for people. That's an extrovert personality. Mm-hmm. But I saw a lot of newsreel footage stuff on him. I actually saw, you know, he did a lot of cameos like Mr. Ed, you know, in the 1960s television.
Oh, yeah.
Television.
I mean, he was all over radio TV.
All over. Uh-huh. But one thing that – for me, and I don't know what the hell it was that caught me, He had a certain cadence to his speaking, but, you know, it kind of changed. Like when he was presenting it, like they'd have newsreels say, here we are with Leo DeRocher and the Brooklyn Dodgers training camp. Leo, how's it look like today? You know, and that would be off. Mm-hmm. And then they would cut to, well, it looks like we got a ball club with so he was presenting himself in a certain way that way, and then I'd see him on TV shows, and he spoke a little differently. So mm-hmm. I didn't know where to place. I didn't know who he was, and I saw him on talk shows, and I was like, right. I'm not sure. So I just played with that, toyed with that. But of the weirdest of the weirdest things was I saw newsreel footage of him hitting balls out to his infield
mm-hmm.
with a long, thin bat called a fungo. And again, because I can't show you, most people throw it up. If you're a righty, you hold the bat in your right hand, you throw the ball up with your left hand, and then you put both hands on the bat and you hit. He held the bat with his left hand, cross throwing the ball up with his right hand. No. People at home are scratching their head going, don't care. But there was something in that movement to me. I went, I know who he is.
Hmm.
Really? Interesting.
And there was something about you're different. You go against the grain. I didn't intellectualize it. I just went, that's it. That's what he does.
Yeah. Mm. See, but this is, you're an actor. You unlock that.
And a friend of mine said, I haven't heard from him in 10 years. he was a director and a fellow actor. He said to me, nice lefty work on the fungo.
Whoa.
He knew.
Wow.
I got goosebumps. And I was like, I said, you got it. You couldn't have said a nicer thing to me.
Oh, that is a great compliment.
Yeah, it's the stuff that you go, because what is it? 1,000,001 people won't know the difference and won't care.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But that one person goes, I see you. I'm like, there you go. I don't need to say anything more. So that just means that tiny dopey things mean something to me. And as soon as you imbue it with meaning,
yeah.
There you are.
Where did you grow up?
Washington, D.C.
I've heard of that.
In Alexandria, Virginia.
Okay.
Yeah, but D.C.
And that's where you spent most of your teen years?
Up till I was 12 and then out to Alexandria till I was 17 and then I was gone.
Then you were gone.
Yeah. University of Colorado, went home. Lived at home for about 6 months and then went up to New York.
Wow. Did you just always know? Is it one of those things?
No. I actually quit school. I took an acting class.
Mm.
And it was the first time in my life I said to myself, oh my God, I think I know more than these people just inherently. And the most important thing to me was I know how much I don't know. And I know what they're teaching me here, and I love University of Colorado, they're not teaching me what I need mm-hmm. enough. I'm not trying to.
No.
I knew I was like, I need to go to the center, to a,
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
And I thought it was LA, but it wasn't. It was New York for me.
Yeah. Well, for a lot of people.
Yeah. I really feel that that old cliche, you make it here, you make it anywhere kind of thing. I was like, there's something there. I think if you want to go to New York, you're going there to be an actor as opposed to that thing of if you go to Hollywood, you want to be discovered.
Mm. Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I quit college and I went to Hollywood to be discovered. And they told me to get lost. So.
But were you a good waiter?
No, I didn't even last that long. I mean, they told me to get lost. Yeah. And I had no money. And all I had was a motorcycle, a leather jacket, and a duffel bag and a sleeping bag. So I went back to school, got my degree, and went up to New York.
And what's your degree in?
History.
Mm.
So, Mike.
No, you like details.
But here's the irony. My specialty was recent diplomatic history, which was our fight against communism. And, that collapsed.
I was going to say,
So I had nothing to do. But now I have a lot to say because, Russia's our best friend.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So you didn't just go to New York. You went to the famous Neighborhood Playhouse.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you got to study with Sanford Meisner.
Well, this was always a problem. I've had to correct this all along the way.
And you didn't get to study with Sanford.
I did not. I got to
I was going to say that. That was how I meant it to come out, actually.
I went to the summer session, and they asked me back to do their 2-year program. Well, I couldn't go. I couldn't do 8 hours of schooling. I just couldn't do it anymore. So I studied with Richard Pinter at night. And the other time I was trying to, you know, being a bouncer, being a weight trainer, being a bartender.
Yeah, see, but I think that's just as important as whatever you were getting out of your classes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because you were living life. I mean, there are people who've done nothing but take acting classes.
Yes.
And some of them turn out to be very good actors. But you've experienced things that they haven't.
Yeah.
And all sorts of things.
Well, you know, and I'll also say this, I always, and I knew this, especially in retrospect, 2020 hindsight's always fun, that the life I was leading was a story unto itself, which I mean, it really was. I arrived in New York with a duffel bag, a typewriter, and a case of tuna fish. And those three things, I mean, what's what I carried with me. You know, I ate the tuna fish, and that's what I would have for lunch and dinner. But, you know, the first 6 months, I lived on 6 different couches, you know, for kindness of strangers, relying on the kindness of strangers. You know, I lived in Harlem. I'd live in Chelsea. You know, you'd be my roommate because my other roommate is off on a cruise.
Right.
You know, everyone's an actor doing their theater gig or something. And I was holding down 3 jobs at once at one time. I was being paid $40 a day as a bouncer. I mean, you try living in New York City on $40 a day, even if it was 30 years ago. It was crazy.
But I mean, I feel like for everyone I know who's managed that, I have such respect. Even now, when I have friends who've moved out from all over the world, but I mean, especially when you're from the middle of America, and they come here and they don't know anybody, and they just want to do it. Same thing when my dad's from New York. When we're over there, and you meet people where they just left their home and they came there because they knew they had to do it.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because that takes, I mean, more than guts. I mean, I'm spoiled. I'm from here. I didn't have to leave to get to L.A. I was already here, which is why I say to all my L.A. friends, you have to leave L.A. You can live here eventually, but you need to leave because you have to understand what everybody else does, which is, you know, you're not born with that impetus of, I know that by the time I'm 18, I can't live here anymore. Because if I want to achieve the dreams I have, you got to get out.
Yeah, you know, I at least as far as I'm concerned, I think it's very weird. I think, and I hope this comes off in the appropriate way, outwardly, if you look the way I look, which, you know, I'm a presentable package. I was relatively athletic. You know, so you go, so what's the problem? And if you don't know, you don't know. But you know there's a problem. And I liken it to, you know, people who are like, you know, struggling with their sexuality or, you know, they're struggling with something within them and they don't know what it is. And, you know, and I realize, like, you know, where I'm at, where I am and what I'm doing is I'm unfulfilled. And I haven't found whatever it is I'm looking for, whether it's within me or something out there. And, you know, that's what acting gave to me. And, you know, And I'll say this, that is what makes me, I feel so lucky because I'm always so grateful that I found it. I always feels like, you can talk about, you know, anything I've done, you know, great. I'm just so happy to be where I'm at, to have had the experiences I've had. And I think at the end of the day, it's to find happiness, to find a place where I can wake up and go, God, I made it. Oh, because of all the things you've done and the money. It's like, no. Just that I've found a place of peace. I can have peace. And, you know, that comes from me being happy and me having my kids and my family and all this other stuff.
You have a partner.
Yeah, all of it. All of it.
What a wonderful way to feel.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever heard an actor express what you just did, the way you just did.
Oh, well.
I mean, there's a lot of actors who enjoy what they do, who love what they do. But you've articulated it in a very moving way, and that's really, really nice to hear.
Well, thanks. You know, it's – and I think because I always see it as a journey with no end.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's no there, you know.
Right. Mm.
There's so, you know, I'm climbing the mountaintop.
Okay. Yeah. So along the way, so when you were young, who inspired you?
Well, you know, first of all, I wanted to be a football player.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got older, you know, in high school, I was like, you know, I couldn't acknowledge that I didn't have the requisite skill set. So I passively allowed that to slide by, and I had nothing to fill my life with. So that was a mistake, not being proactive in that and either saying, you know, go to a Division III school and try your hand at playing football, knowing that you're not, you know, D3 players don't get recruited and, you know, your NFL career is over, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to continue to play football, go to a smaller school and give it a shot. So I had nothing to fill. So in the meantime, I found that as I would – and I remember this very – clearly, I remember I was in fifth grade and we went to go see Little Big Man. And my sister brought me, my older sister, and went with my brother. And that was like just the three kids. And go. And I don't know if you remember Little Big Man, but you know,
yeah.
There are little racy parts to it, but nothing too big. And it was, I love that movie. That was another like kind of life changer.
That's a hell of a movie.
Yeah.
Very profound. And I didn't understand the underlying profundities of mm-hmm. it, you know, the kind of the anti-war mm-hmm. aspect to it and all that stuff. But I felt as though I got a lot of things out of it that I hadn't seen before through entertainment. Came home and I remember my mother going, how was it? My sister, being the oldest, said, well, I think it was a little too much for Christopher. You know, it was a little racy for Christopher. And I'm like, girl, what the hell are you talking about? I got it in ways that you didn't get it. But it was – and what it was Dustin Hoffman. And he was one of my first guys because his acting, I remember him going up to Custer in that particular movie and he said, you know, what were you doing living with the Indians? You know, he's Custer, suspect of him. And he starts laugh crying, going, oh, man, they tortured me. And I just laughed and laughed. And all he's thinking about is how the soldiers came. Custer's soldiers came and wiped out mm-hmm. his life and his family. And I was like, wow. I don't know what you're doing, but I know what you're doing.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm seeing this clearly. It was the same way when I saw him in Marathon Man,
mm-hmm.
when Olivier is saying, "Is it safe?" And you know, he's about to be tortured by this guy if he doesn't give the right answer, and he's like, no, it's very dangerous. So you better watch yourself." And Olivier just keeps going, "Is it safe?" No, it's in grave danger, so you better. He didn't know what the right answer was. And I just remember seeing that going, how did he think of that? What is that? I didn't know what that was.
Yeah.
But I just knew it was brilliantly conceived and executed, and I understood it. And so anyway, those were hero – these moments, these I guess the heroic moments, and not from a quote-unquote hero, but – heroic acting moments.
Well, he's one of the great actors of our time.
Yes. Yes. But, you know, great moments only happen so often.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Brando going yelling Stella, or Brando ripping the cups mm-hmm. off the table. They only come along. You know, you say, oh, Brando was great, and then he
yeah.
was great.
Yeah.
And all that. But the moments, to me, mm-hmm. I have snapshots.
Yeah.
And those,
yeah.
to me, become, I guess, inspiring moments.
Well, the yeah. same thing as how a song can make you cry, or it can immediately take you to certain emotions or certain feelings. When you see certain scenes, it just that stays with you.
Yeah,
you can pick it up and put it in your pocket, and it never goes away.
Now, how yeah. about as a young, or maybe even not so young actor, being on a set with another actor and observing somebody close up? Any moments come to mind where you were kind of
– Angela Lansbury.
Oh, yeah.
So she did an SVU episode. And being in her presence was like being in a tractor beam. And I've never felt that before. Since I've felt, you know, at times, she was amazing. She was uncompromising in her focus and what she would just effortlessly lay down behaviorally. It was one of the most amazing feelings I've ever had. And I got to talk to her about the picture of Dorian Gray, portrait of Dorian Gray. I said, I go, was that your first film? Was that your first? And she said, no, my second or third, whatever it was. I said, and she was like 17 or 19, something like that.
She was very young.
Young, very young.
Yeah.
And I said, I was a 12 or 10, a 10-year-old boy, and I'm on the bed, you know, watching my parents' TV, right? Mm. You know, the rabbit ears. I said, and there's a portrait of Dorian Gray, and I'm watching this black and white film with, and I didn't know who she was, but I said, the scene was one. I said, it's basically, and she knows where I'm going with it, but I said, basically, Dorian says, you know, get the hell out of here unless you're willing to put out, right? And you're heartbroken because you think it's love, and you turn and walk away. And I remember being on the bed going, oh, you're not, keep walking, sister, keep walking. And she turns, you see the shadow turn, she comes, she walks back in the room, and you know. You know, that he has polluted her soul, that he's ensnared her. And I was, you know, I was telling her all about it. She's just looking at her like, yeah. I was so more excited about the whole thing. And again, it's the moment. I remember that moment of an actor in Did anyone out there get that? Was that as interesting to me?
Well, but she's remarkable.
Yeah.
I had that experience when on my first trip here. I grew up in New Jersey, New York and New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And when I made my first trip here as a teenager and got to interview a couple of actors for the first time, and I interviewed this wonderful old character actor and comedian named Billy Gilbert, and he had done something on TV when I was a kid that I thought was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And I just had to ask him about it, and he looked at me funny. And he'd had a stroke, so he had some memory loss, mm-hmm. but his wife remembered everything. And he turned to her and she said, oh, Billy, you remember we shot that. It was for a show called Andy's Gang, hosted by the great Andy Devine. And he did all of his segments in one day. So this was one day in his career 40 years ago. And it's very immediate to me and very vivid to my psyche, mm-hmm. my consciousness. And it was a speck in his life. It meant something at the time because he did a lovely job. But it was over, done with, decades ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, and I learned that was a lesson. It was a good lesson for me.
Yeah.
And
I didn't learn that lesson.
and some people are gracious about it.
Yeah.
She was.
As Angela Lansbury is the definition of gracious.
Yes.
She is that personified. Other people go, oh, that's nice, thank you.
We've been burned a lot, like a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, just, it's not that they're rude or impolite.
It can just be that there's something really, or the way you're phrasing it. So it's sort of that thing where if I'm in detail, I went up to an actress who I loved and I'd grown up watching her in this one particular movie and I went over and I just went, oh my God, when you did this, this, and this, and this, and that, and you could just see her going completely blank and just staring like, when is this child going to shut up? So then I finished it and I kind of went, just want to say thank you. And I walked away and I cried. I went to my mom. I was like, she hates me and she doesn't understand. And he just, it's tough.
No. It's just a different, but that's the power. That and of course that's the lasting power of anything on film or on videotape is that it's there forever. So in your mind, that Angela Lansbury, that 18, 19-year-old Angela Lansbury who sings Goodbye Little Yellow Bird in Dorian Gray is immediate. It's immediate to you and it's distant to her.
Yeah.
And why shouldn't it be? She's lived a full and rich life. And done so many performances in the interim.
Oh, I know that now. You don't have to rub it in.
What are your kids like?
What are my kids like?
Yeah.
My daughter, Sophia, is incredibly smart. She is an old soul. She was born that way. Never used that word before she came out of the womb. She is... an educator to me. I'm an educator to her as far as oldies music goes. She listens to all of her music on vinyl.
Mm. You know,
one
good
of my
man.
Proudest moments yes. is when I got the call saying, "Daddy, meet me at Amoeba because I want you to help me pick out the best David Bowie album, Led Zeppelin album." It went down the list, Steely Dan.
You done good.
Yeah, oh, yeah. She's the bomb. We've been to a concert in Paris together. The whole family went. One of her bands, the 1975. And we're going to go see Tool together, the rock band Tool.
Daddy, you want to go see Tool with me?
That's my favorite.
There you go. There you go.
You know, so, yeah, we hang, we kick it. And my son, Dante, is 13, and he's an athlete. He is a straight shooter. He's a young man who's just he's a heart first kind of kid.
Can't imagine where he gets that from.
Well, I don't know. You know, I got to tell you, I'm just so blessed. And we're a pretty tight unit. You know, my wife and my kids and myself, we're pretty tight.
Yeah, we're a Molten Triangle. I get it.
There you go.
Everyone knows us as the three of us.
Bingo.
We like it.
Will you forgive a cliche interviewer type question?
Go.
Is there anybody you love to work with? So somebody like just comes right to mind.
Anyone I would like to?
Yeah, who's still working, still alive, still ambulatory?
Right. Who would I like to work with?
Still ambulatory.
Robert De Niro.
Okay. Well, yeah. Good choice.
He's always been my first choice. Yeah. I just, and I don't know. There's something about that guy. You know, he was again to me a life changer, and it was specifically. You know, and I remember all these moments. I remember the moments. It's, you know, the moment is, you know, let's do it in film. You know, cold winter day, all the leaves are off the trees. A starving, struggling actor whose name nobody knows trundles down the street, 34th Street, to go into the theater at midday because he has nothing to do with his day or his life at this particular time. He goes into the theater, what is playing? Raging Bull.
Mm.
And, you know, you just, it's as if hope is renewed as well as an opening of all the potentials of your art form are in front of you, both visually and acting, and the potential of what can be is splayed out before you. And, you know, lights come up and you are the only person, you just sit there as they sweep the floor around you and you can't get up. Because you are, oh, man.
Well, that's about as good as it gets, you know, that performance and that movie.
Yeah, it really is.
Will you read me stories to go to sleep?
You know, I will
listen to you read any story in the world.
I used to do that with my daughter. That was our thing.
Yeah, my parents read to me every night.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And she still wouldn't go to sleep.
Yeah, I will. God, Dad. Yeah, it's true. Never went to sleep.
Well, I mean, as I say, you know, it seems like you have good taste.
Yeah.
I will
say
that.
Top shelf all the way, my man.
And why not?
Have you shown your kids Raging Bull?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah, you know, I'll show my son the – and I've told my daughter as well. I said, you know – and I told my daughter actually first because she was taking acting lessons. I said, you want to see a master class in acting, just check out Raging Bull. See what they're doing, the give and take, the back and forth.
When did you rewatch it?
Just a few years ago, and it was like it was made yesterday.
I came home, and he and my mom were watching it.
When it came out on Blu-ray, we said, we haven't seen this since it was new, since the day it opened.
Mm-hmm.
Seen excerpts, but we hadn't watched the film start to finish. And Alice and I sat there, mesmerized.
It looked like they'd been hit by a freight train.
And when it was over,
like...
we felt the same way we felt that day we saw it in 1980. 1980, I think so. And wow. Wow. What do you say? I'll tell you my first memory of De Niro, though. My first memory is going to the Rialto Theater in Richfield Park, New Jersey, to see a film called Mean Streets.
Yeah.
And I didn't know anybody in it. And Harvey Keitel is the star. He's got the leading role. Yeah. And then there's this really screwy, skinny kid who's nuts. Who plays a guy who's really nuts? He's screw loose. And I thought to myself, where did they find this guy? they found this wacko on the streets and somehow corralled him to be in this movie. I couldn't believe it was an actor giving a performance. Yeah. That's what I remember about the first time I was conscious of Robert De Niro. And when I learned that it was, of course, an actor, not a fluke of nature, yeah. It's like, whoa, boy, this yep. guy. I'm looking out for this guy. And, of course, I wasn't the only one who felt that way. And he can still bring it. So I hope you do get to work with him.
Thank you.
In something worthy of both your talents.
And then you can call him Bobby and we can have those weird conversations where someone says to you, well, you know, when Bobby said, every time someone does that, it's like first time that I got to meet Anthony Hopkins, my dad was interviewing. He goes, Tony. And you go, no, yeah. you're Anthony Hopkins. Every time you hear somebody tell a story about Robert De Niro and they go, well, you know, Bobby said, and every time a little part of me just goes, no.
Well, I'm still the guy who has to call him Robert.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Christopher, thank you so much for coming today.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
And people can see you everywhere.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
People don't have to – they don't have to journey far to find you.
But you do – you have a Twitter and you have an Instagram.
Yeah.
They're both your name.
Yeah.
Chris Maloney. So people can follow you there
yeah.
and find your stuff. And you will be posting your wife's gorgeous paintings.
Yep.
Which they are
on
fantastic.
Instagram.
Those yeah. They really are. They look
I'm going
like,
to do it right now.
They look like pictures. They look like photographs.
That's right.
And that's, I mean, and that obviously is, you've married another artist. You're an artist who married an artist.
And I got to tell you that it's one of the greatest pleasures of my life
yeah.
to go outside to a little painting studio and marvel and yeah. truly be able to go, how do you do this? Like watching an alchemist at work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's so life-giving.
Oh, that's
so it's a little selfish on my part, even though, you know, it makes me sound like the great husband. It's like more like, thank you for feeding me.
Right?
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
It must be very nourishing indeed.
It is.
Thank you once again. Jesse, what should we be telling people?
I am where you am. I'm at Jesse Malton and you're at Leonard Malton.
It's all true.
And people can subscribe to leonardmalton.com.
Yes, you can read me whenever you like on my website at leonardmalton.com. And you can fill in a simple box on that homepage and get email blasts for free, absolutely free. We can do that.
A little extra Malton in your life.
That's right.
Just a little extra.
And we will see you right back here next week. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.